Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist. With me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Toby Lloyd about his literary novel, Fervour. Toby was born in London to a secular father and a Jewish mother. He studied English at Oxford University before moving to America to pursue an MFA in creative writing at NYU. He's published short stories and essays in several publications and was longlisted for the 2021 V.S. Pritchett Short Story Prize. In this episode, we discuss taking inspiration from Bible stories, how he tried to represent a variety of Jewish experiences, and why having your work critiqued is one of the most valuable things you can do when starting out. But first, here's Toby with an excerpt from Fervour.
One night, Hannah got in late and found Eric sitting at the foot of the stairs, the phone nestled in his shoulder and its cord wrapped around his finger. Aside from the light hanging above the downstairs landing, the house was dark. Still buzzing from the meeting she'd had with her agent to discuss her manuscript, and a little tipsy from drinks with a former colleague, she knew at once something had happened. Her husband looked ridiculous, crouched there in the hallway. He hadn't changed out of his suit, still had his shoes on. He hung up on whoever it was without replacing the phone in its cradle, just squeezing the button below the earpiece. Where the hell have you been? Was Eric drunk? She'd told him that morning she'd be back late. Now she slung her coat over the banister and asked, with deliberate calm, what was going on? Elsie's gone! Do you know how many people I've called? I even tried your parents. You can imagine how that went down. She never came home. The boys are clueless. Fat lot of use the school's been. They didn't even notice. Can you believe it? No one even saw her going. With the fees they charge, you think they could post someone at the gate? Slow down. You're not making sense. She's missing, Hannah. Don't you understand? It's late, it's dark out, and nobody knows where she is. Hannah took this in with a nod. Something kept her from exploding into panic. A small miracle. Hashem had blessed her with the cool lucidity demanded. You've called the police. She's 14 years old, for fuck's sake. Hannah bent down, cupped her hand around the back of her husband's sodden neck, and pressed her thumb to the base of his skull. She'll be back, she said. And then, as if editing herself, we'll find her.
Hi, Toby. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, Fervour.
Hi, Chloe. Thanks for having me. Lovely to be here.
So, Toby, can you start by telling us what Fervour's about?
In the most general sense, I think it's about belief. It's about like what people believe is kind of, and because it's a novel about Jewish characters, what Jews believe is really at the heart of the book, thematically, in more of a sort of plot sense. What I'd say about it is it's about a family of very religious Jewish people who have very literal understanding of scripture and of the presence of God in the world. and they have a troubled teenage daughter who behaves quite oddly, and they become convinced that she is under the sway of demonic influences. And the youngest son of the family is a passionate atheist, and he thinks his parents are insane, and he thinks they are the problem. And that's the central conflict of the novel.
Yeah, oh, I have been singing the praises of this book because I just think it's so unique, and it's just like nothing I've ever read before, and that's why I enjoyed it so much. I've seen your novel described as quite a few things, like family drama, horror, ghost story. What kind of novel did you set out to write, and what was your kind of starting point for this book?
Yeah, well, thanks for being so kind about the book. My feeling, I don't know how other novelists do it. I feel like there was no one clear starting point. There were several starting points. It wasn't that one day I sat down and wrote, now I begin further, and it's going to be about this and that and that. So there were a few kind of, there was a kind of constellation of things that happened or that I became interested in. One of them was reading the Bible very seriously and closely in my 20s as an atheist. I'm not a believer. And I'd always shied away from the Bible, thinking this is a thing for people who believe this stuff to read and learn how to live their lives by. And I didn't know what I started reading it again, but I read it, read those first few narrative books, the Bible, Genesis and Exodus. And in the same way that you might read, like, you know, the Greek myths, Homer, or Virgil, the Latin. And I found it fascinating. I was like, these are really, really interesting literary stories. I think that it's a mistake for those of us who are book lovers and are not believers to ignore it. And I thought these stories are stranger and more troubling and less obviously moralistic than I thought they would be. And I thought that there was something I could do with that in modern fiction. So that was one starting point. Another starting point was being very interested in people with strong religious views. That's not just Jews, that's also Christians and Muslims and, you know, and so on. And spending a lot of time with religious people and becoming really interested in how different their worldview was from mine, and wanted to write about that. And then I guess a sort of third starting point was that I love horror films, more so than horror novels. I don't honestly read loads and loads of horror. There's stuff I like, but I'm very into horror films, and especially some very recent horror films that I think have used horror to write about kind of family dynamics and develop character in a way that's really interesting. And I'm thinking particularly of like Robert Eggers' film The Witch, Ari Aster's Hereditary, St. Maud, The Babadook. These films all sort of get kind of joined together, I think rightly so, as quite serious character studies that make use of all the thrills of the horror. Wanting to combine those elements with a sort of modern Bible story sort of thing. And somewhere along the line, I had this book that I was like, okay, it's kind of, but this is kind of what it is now.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about kind of how your influences came together. I'm similar in the sense that my ideas tend to come to me as like fragments and kind of puzzle pieces, and then eventually it's like, can these fit together? How am I going to do it? And those movies that you mentioned, I wouldn't class myself as a horror fan, but I love those films. I can't deal with kind of jump scare type films, but I really enjoy the kind of modern, some kind of like what do they call it, like folk horror, I suppose. One of the reasons I really loved your book was that it really kind of digs into British Jewish life in a way that I've never read in a novel before. And I think I've read a lot about American Jewish people and seen a lot in films and in a lot of literary fiction, but never in British novels, and particularly kind of the diversity of belief. You've got the kind of the mother figure, who's that kind of writer in a newspaper who's very controversial. And it's that I find that kind of really fascinating, how they all live together and clash. And we'll talk about a little bit about that in a minute. But I wondered whether you were kind of keen to explore things that you felt like you'd never read yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably every writer views what they're doing as kind of original in some way. Like, that's and like, in a way, it's good not to be aware of some of your forebears, because if you believed, oh, I'm just going down the same old tracks as everyone else, it'd be very hard to write a book. And I think, yeah, absolutely, I agree with you about the comparative wealth of American Jewish fiction, and which is explained in part just by demographics. The number of Jews who live in America versus the number of Jews who live in Britain is much, much higher. And so, you know, the influences for the book, with some exceptions, very few of them are British writers. A lot of them are not writing even in English. So, you know, I'm thinking about American writers like Philip Roth and Saul Bellow and Cynthia Osek and Francine Prose, but also European writers, Franz Kafka, Elias Canetti, and further back, sort of the Hasidic tales written in sort of, you know, Yiddish and German and Hebrew. So to my mind, there aren't a lot of books like mine written in Britain. There are probably more than I'm aware of. But yeah, that was something I was thought could be mined.
It is that, I guess, that dilemma that every writer has, where you feel like everything's been done before, and you need to find your own kind of original thing. And is there such thing as an original story? And I don't know whether you had this panic, but I know a lot of people have had this panic where you're happily writing your novel, and then you read a blurb from a book that's about to come out, and you're like, wait a minute, this sounds like my book.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's because also when you're writing a book, you become so obsessed with the ideas in it, you see them everywhere. So yeah, you kind of project your book onto the rest of the world. But I also think that's one of the reasons why authors are sometimes attracted to updating kind of classics or legends or whatever, which my book does to a degree, with one particular biblical story, because it's like, well, I definitely know the way this is not original, you know, like it's no longer the sort of unspoken elephant in the room. Everyone knows this is a rewrite of whatever Greek legend I've decided to pick, you know?
Yeah, you can call it out before they say it, basically.
Yeah.
So one thing I found so interesting when I was reading this novel is that it opens with your kind of narrative voice. It's this omniscient character kind of telling us about the family, dipping into each of their histories and their personalities. And then we move on to Oxford, and it is Oxford, right?
It is Oxford, yep. Yep.
And I was just suddenly panicked that it was Cambridge. It's Oxford, okay. And we move on to this other perspective, which is Kate at university. And I was wondering, kind of, was it a conscious choice to kind of use this? Because obviously when we dip from the family to Kate, you're still using this kind of all-knowing voice. Was it a conscious decision to pick that kind of style, or what were you kind of playing around with, whose story am I going to tell this from, what perspective, or did that kind of voice come to you straight away?
I think, yeah, I'm glad you've asked about this. It's I think a lot of writers come to a point in writing a book, I know plenty of friends of mine with similar experiences, where they decide that the book they're writing, the way they've decided to write it, is impossible. It's not going to work. Something about, you know, there's no ending that's going to pull it off, or there's no, and there's something about the way they decide to write this book. I've written a first person book, and the first person character can't possibly tell me this other thing that happened, so the book is impossible. And for me, perspective was almost from the beginning the difficult thing, of that I wanted somewhat to have my cake and eat it. In that, on the one hand, I knew that I had to get very close to Rosenthal family and go inside all of their heads, and that necessitates an omniscient narrator who sees and knows everything. On the other hand, I needed to keep them at a distance at times. And I think, and it's the classic sort of a horror movie trope in a way, is if you've got a monster, not that they are monsters, but they are the fascinating part of the book. Kate is in herself not fascinating in the same way. you can't just show the monster all the time. You have to keep it off screen. You have to, and then when it comes on, it's like really exciting. And narratively, the family the fact that Kate has a partial view of them, that there's a lot that Kate doesn't know, and she has to sort of guess at, or the reader has to supply, was part of the novel. And it having both these things, having wanting to have total access to the family and also limited access to the family, seemed at a point impossible to resolve. So that's where this dual narration came from. And I eventually took heart from what you always take heart from, which is other writers. And I found that other novelists have done similar strange things. Actually, I just read a book by Carol Phillips, Crossing the River. He's a writer I admire a lot, and he does odd things with one chapter is an epistolary novel, the next chapter is an omniscient third, the next chapter is a first person. He jumps back and forth in time. And as a writer, you fear that if you do that, someone's gonna go, nah, this doesn't follow. I'm not going with this. But as a reader, I very happily went with it in Carol Phillips. So yeah, I hope similarly people will accept, we'll see, my jumps in perspective.
Yeah, I think it's that thing, isn't it? Particularly when you're a new writer, you're like, can I pull this off? Are people just going to think that I don't know what I'm doing and I'm just kind of like having a go and doing it badly? And you almost felt like you need that validation of someone to go, yes, this does work and it is fine. And luckily you do have that because you have people that want to read it and editors and such. But when you're just sitting there at home writing, you're thinking, oh, I think this works, but I have no idea. I think that is always the hard thing about writing is that you have to kind of use that judgment and you don't always know whether you're doing the right thing or not. Was Kate the late invention to kind of make the narrative work, or did you, I guess you had this idea of her being the kind of I guess the every woman, and then obviously we're building up to a climax and her going to the Rosenthal house is the kind of, the climax of the horror film as such. So was she kind of an invention to make the narrative work, or did you always think I need a Kate in the story?
The honest answer is, at this point, I started writing the book in 2017, just to give you some context, roughly. And at this point, it's quite hard for me to reconstruct exactly what order I did what. I know that I started writing a narrative that was in Oxford, around, I'm forgetting the book now, 2010, 2009, that sort of time. And that scene in the lecture theatre where Eli Schultz, academic that I invented, gives this lecture. I wrote that quite early on, and I was writing this other thing, involving this family, and the grandfather family being close to his death. I don't even know, I don't remember which came first of those two. I don't know at what point they became the same novel. They might have actually been separate projects at one point. I forget that. So the
No.
answer is no, I didn't always know I needed a Kate.
It's fascinating, isn't it? And how these things happen. I started writing my novel in 2016, and kind of similarly to you, bits came so much later that ended up being completely fundamental to the novel. And then you look back and you're like, how was that not part of the novel from the beginning? And you forget which bits you added where, but somehow it comes together. I wanted to ask you a bit more about the Rosenthal family. Did you kind of deliberately, when you were kind of shaping their characters, think, how can I make them be as volatile and clashing and opposing as possible?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. Yeah, it was. I mean, for one thing, no one wants to read a book where everyone gets along for 400 pages. So just for that, you think, I mean, one imagines that when TV producers put together Big Brother or Love Island or whatever, they think, oh, this person's really going to wind up that person. This
Yeah.
would be great telly. And the lofted art of fiction is not so different, I suppose. So there's that. And the other thing is that I felt, I knew from very early on that I wanted to write this book about British Jews, and I wanted to have a very broad sense of what a British Jew is, and that meant having British Jews who were Orthodox, who were liberal, who were secular, who were, you know, atheists, who were Zionists, who were anti-Zionists, queer, you know, having as many different ideas of a Jew as I could reasonably get into a book. So to avoid any crude thing of putting forward a character as representative of a people, you know, I'm saying British Jews are this one person, and, yes, you know, so that was the other thing that went into deciding the characters will have a slightly different relationship to God in that family, actually.
Do you think by kind of, I was wondering this when I was reading, actually, because I was thinking, I wonder how readers, Jewish readers, would respond to this, whether they would see themselves in a character or whether they would, I don't know, have some maybe negative pushback. Were you thinking about that when you were writing it?
I think, yeah, inevitably. I mean, I think you do imagine readers, and you imagine hostile readers, and so far, I think the response from Jewish readers has been really positive, which has been really pleasing to me. I mean, my agent is Jewish, so I've been very lucky to sell the American rights and sell various translation rights. Most of my editors internationally are Jewish, although my British editors aren't. My American editor is, and most of my translation editors are Jewish. So, you know, there has been a very positive response from Jewish readers. And I think that, yes, I part of me was frightened that certain believers would take issue with the way I represent, you know, certain elements of religious practice and so on. But I also think if you set out to write a book that offends nobody, that nobody could possibly have an exception to, what kind of novel is that going to be? It sounds pretty dull to me, you know.
I don't know. Have you looked at any reviews, or have you stayed away from that kind of side of it? I know your book's not officially out yet, but I'm sure it's been in the hands of some readers.
So the professional reviews, the early ones who have been very positive, had starred reviews from Kirkus and from Publishers Weekly, which was really cool. I clicked on Goodreads, mostly because I was surprised there were any Goodreads. I was like, the book's not out. It's obviously people who've got proofs and so on. And of course, the morbid fascination, you're like, okay, who's written the nasty reviews or who haven't liked it? But generally, you know, the people who've put one or two stars or whatever haven't said anything. So they haven't, yeah. I was going to say also, in response to your last question as well, the other thing that I bore in mind as I was writing is that there is a great history of Jewish writers being denounced by the rabbinate. And you can go all the way back to Spinoza, who was essentially excommunicated. And in more recent times, you know, Philip Roth, when he wrote Portnoy's Complaint, and the great scholar at the University of Jerusalem, Gershom Scholem, said this book is more damaging to the Jews than the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. What an extraordinary review for a novel. This is likened to a book that was, you know, caused pogroms across Europe, you know. And similarly, you know, there are other examples. Polish writer Sholem Asch, or more recently, David Grossman, has been accused by his own government of being, you know, anti-Jews. So I sort of think part of the game that some people may react like that, you know.
I felt like you know, don't aim that high, but as long as you're not getting those kind of reviews, you'll be okay. I wanted to briefly talk about Elsie because part of the novel explores whether she's a young woman who is suffering from mental health problems or whether she is possessed and there's some kind of witchcraft element to it. I wondered, obviously you talked about being inspired by horror movies and there's a talk in the novel about Jewish folklore. Was that something you had looked into and researched?
Yeah, absolutely. I find Jewish folklore really, really interesting. Specifically, the Hasidic tales that sort of emerged in the old Kingdom of Poland in the 18th century, because they sit somewhere between scripture and secular literature. What I mean by that is that, if you are a if you're a fervent believer, you believe in the truth of the Torah. No one believes in the truth of modern fiction, and I don't think anyone would really believe in the literal truth of the Hasidic tales, which have stories of wonder rabbis who perform miracles, and they have battles with demons and dibbuks and so on. But they are written by religious authorities for the purpose of religious instruction, and so therefore they have certain affinities with the the legends of the Bible. Yeah, I became very interested in some of the tropes of these stories, and I because I'm also for the longest time I just wasn't at all aware of them until you start researching stuff for a novel and you become interested in these things that you didn't know were there. And yeah, it seemed very rich to make use of.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you must have done an incredible amount of research for this novel, but I wanted to ask kind of on a practical level, really. You said that you started writing this in possibly 2017 and in a fragmentary way, writing different bits and pieces that you weren't sure whether they made one whole novel. Did you move on for, when you were kind of thinking of this novel and it was taking shape, did you kind of come up with a plan, or were you just kind of like writing towards an ending that you had in mind? What was your kind of process, and when did you realize that this might have legs or potential as a novel?
Well, I'll talk about the planning first, and then the second bit about having legs. I'm dreadful one for not planning. I didn't plan the novel really at all. I intend to plan my next novel because writing this took a long time and it was a slightly chaotic process. I tend to get excited and just start writing without knowing where I'm going to go. And I think the way I would put it is that you do need to know where you're going when you write the final draft, but not necessarily when you write your first draft. That said, yeah, it was a very arduous and long process, and I wonder if there are better ways to write a novel, but that's how you learn. When did I start to think it had legs? Well, that was it just came from other people, really, very early readers, trusted readers, friends, and so on, who read a sort of something like a finished draft, and were excited about it. I didn't have, I mean, lots of times I had no faith in it whatsoever. I very nearly abandoned the book several times, partly because of things like I was told you earlier about what seemed to be impossible, the problems of the narrative that seemed to be unresolvable. And it, it's always quite attractive to stop writing a book and start writing something new. This beautiful first sentence with none of the clutter and none of the difficulties that you've built for yourself.
Yeah, there's always that feeling of like, maybe this new idea is going to be easier to write, so I'll do that one instead.
Yeah, precisely.
And then a new problem crops up, and you're like, oh, okay. And I don't know about you, but I find sometimes that I had this idea where I was like, right, the next book's going to be much simpler. It's going to have a simpler narrative, and then an idea pops up which is not at all simple, and then you start to think, why can't I just think of a really straightforward plot? But
Yeah.
unfortunately, our brains are not that kind to us, so we have to write what we come up with. I know you've written short stories and things, but I wonder kind of where your love of writing began and how it all began. Had you kind of always thought in your mind, like, I want to write a novel, and that's, that's in my head, or did it come kind of when you were in your teens? Where did it all begin for you?
I would say my teens. I would say I was not a big reader as a child. Lots of writers are. I wasn't. But I did sort of become, I guess I became quite interested in art and narrative arts generally. I became very interested in music and the way that a lot of teenagers do, like, sort of contemporary pop music and so on. And became very interested in films, realizing that, like, up until the age of about 13 or 14, the only reason I would go to the cinema would be to see an action film. And then something changed, and I was like, oh, there are films that, like, make you feel other things than just that sort of raw excitement. And starting to read fiction and poetry. So yeah, from about the age of 15, I think I knew that I wanted to write. Not necessarily fiction, maybe scripts, maybe poetry, something. And yeah, I'm going to NYU to do my MFA was probably what clarified exactly what that would look like for me.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, I guess that I often ask writers, like, what point in your life did you decide to kind of take your writing seriously? Because I think a lot of us start, writing as a hobby or writing from a young age, and obviously you did your MFA at NYU. What was your kind of biggest takeaway from that experience, or something that kind of left you with some sort of significance?
I think it was, I always desired to write seriously, or whatever that, that might have meant, the very pretentious 20-year-old I once was. But going there and meeting very successful writers, which most people don't meet in their life as teenagers, and even as an undergraduate, and then doing a master's degree and meeting these very successful writers and hearing from them what their lives were like and what their habits were like, realizing that, okay, And doing this means writing every day, you can. Not just like those odd moments when you have a good idea and then you write for 20 minutes, then you tell yourself, well done, and get on with your life. But actually sort of sitting down at typewriter, this is the 50s, your laptop, day after day. And also it taught me how to get critiqued, because I think I had experience that I think almost every very young writer has, is that you write and then you give it to like your mum or your best friend and they're like, that's great, and you're like, it is, I'm great. and you don't realize there's much work to be done. And when you go and do something like an MFA and you have like 15 people who are all pretty smart, all like also been accepted into this program, have no vested interest in telling you you're good, respond to you honestly, and it's very bruising at first, or can be very bruising. But it's also, I think, so valuable for writers to learn, actually, you could be doing a lot better. Your work could be much, much better. And it might be hard to hear that the first time, but it's only by accepting that there is a gulf between what you're writing and what you'd like to be writing that you can improve.
Yeah, absolutely. I am a bit odd in the fact I really enjoy being critiqued, and I really like my work being edited, and I always get asked this anytime I do an event. Someone always says in the audience, like, what's it like when you have to have your work edited and people want to change things? I'm like, I love it. Yeah, absolutely. Relish in people saying, you know, if you do this to this sentence, or if you take this character in this direction, you're going to improve what you've done dramatically. And then you have a discussion about it, or you go away and think about it. And sometimes people aren't always correct in their assessment, particularly if you get a couple of people that disagree on something. That can be really interesting when someone says, oh, well, I really like this bit, and someone goes, I hated this bit. And then you have to go away and go, how do I feel about it? And does it work? I love it. I think because, like you say, there's always a gap in your writing between the writers that you admire and you would kill to be like them, and your own work. And I always find it, when I read writers I admire, instead of feeling like a bit sick that I can't write as well as that, I'm thinking, but I want to be them, so I'm going to have to work really hard. So I think being critiqued and being edited is amazing. But then I haven't really been made to cry, or, you know, I've wanted to cry, and I've probably cried, and I've tore my hair out a little bit sometimes. But then after a few days, you're like, actually, they are right.
I think you have exactly the right attitude, and that's, you know, anyone who wants to write a book should emulate the attitude you just expressed. I find, I don't like getting the feedback. I know I need it, and so I don't shy away from it. But but what I do enjoy is going back to the manuscript, having read all the editorial comments, and having them bubbling away. And this, I don't know, I mean, it's some sort of insecurity or vanity on my part that my instant reaction is, oh, I don't like this. I'm being, but I know that you have to do that. And then once, it's a feeling of being in control again that I enjoy. If, once you actually, you know, you've sat with someone's comments, and again, what it always comes down to is someone is telling you that you could be doing something that is better than what you've currently done, which is a lovely message to receive, actually, as opposed to, yeah, this is fine.
Yeah.
You know, and going back with the sort of, you know, fresh look at your own work, and actually, I feel like I can bring something else out of this, is, I to me, that's more fun. There's more fun in that than in writing a first draft, writing something totally fresh.
Yeah, I agree, actually. I kind of prefer that stage of when you've already had something written and you're trying to make it better. I always find more appealing than just that awful first draft where you know you're going to have to delete 50% of it. I also do enjoy the critiquing of others' work, and I think there's a lot of value in that. And there's a lot of learning in that because you often see your own mistakes that you do in other people's work, and it's easier to spot them in other people's and go, there you go. And also, I really enjoy finding, we're trying to think of ways to help people improve. I just think that's just a joy because as long as they take it in the correct way and you haven't just told them, that it's terrible, said, this works, but it would work better if. I think it's so valuable. I mean, any course, or I did a master's with creative writing master's, and the critiquing part was definitely the highlight for me as well. Toby, how did you get your agent? Did it kind of come after you'd done your MFA?
No, it was more recent. That was after I had written the full draft of Further. I mean, it wasn't the first draft that I sent to agents. I worked on that first draft with friends and critiquing me, and until I had a draft that I thought was pretty good. I was the a lot of the advice that I had read and been told is that it's better to query agents when you've got a whole manuscript, rather than when you've got a partial manuscript. So I had my whole manuscript. I had my and the other advice that I was given, and I think it's good advice, is that it's tempting. You think, I've spent ages writing this book. The pitch letter is a load of rubbish. That, it's just a silly, it's like a job application, a silly thing that I don't want to dirty my precious writer hands with. But actually, taking the pitch very seriously and trying to write as good a pitch as you can. Exactly the same thing with the synopsis. There's a reason why agents ask these things. They find them very helpful. You should apply yourself, I think, with the same kind of commitment as you do to writing fiction. You try and make that those as readable and as enticing as you can to agents. And when I had a pitch letter, synopsis, my chapters, I queried a bunch of agents.
How long did it take you before you had kind of people wanting to read more?
That happened very quickly. So my agent, I think it was the same week I sent her the opening. I can't remember if it was 10,000 words or 50 pages. I think it was about 3 or 4 days later, she said, "I'm really enjoying this. Send me the whole book." And I did. And I would have looked very silly if I didn't have a whole book to send her at that point.
You'd be up till 1 a.m. kind of, finishing it.
Exactly. And then I think it took her about a month, 6 weeks after that, to kind of get in touch, and then we met, and I.
So for any writer about to go through this experience that you are experiencing now, because your book, as we speak, is a few weeks away from being out in the world. Do you have any advice for people who are about to have their first book published? People who have maybe just signed their contract and they've got 18 months to go before their book's out in the world and they're navigating this strange land of publicity and marketing and all the rest. Would you have any advice for anyone who's about to go through that?
I feel a little bit reluctant to sort of put myself on it, but like, what do I know? But for what it's worth, I would say, try not to compare what is happening to you in your book to other people, because everyone can find some other debut author who's like getting more press or it's more exciting. I always There's a lovely story of Bernard Malamud, who, if people don't know, was of his day an incredibly decorated American novelist. He won the National Book Award, he won the Pulitzer Prize, like one of the five or six highest rated literary novelists of his day. And he was Jewish, and his great rival was Saul Bellow. And there's a diary entry from 1976, I think, in which Bernard Malamud says, "Today I won $20 at pool. Saul Bellow won the Nobel Prize." And I think, if you become as successful as Bernard Malamud, God give us such success. If you became that successful and you're still bitter because of the success of the other guy, then you're just committed to a lifetime of misery. I mean, and so, try not to pay attention to what's happening to other people, and just try and enjoy it, because you go so quickly from thinking, I don't know if I'll ever publish a book. If I just publish a book, that would be the most exciting thing that could ever happen to me. To suddenly being cross that you're not getting a bigger advance or getting a better,
I know,
your goals are, so that would be my advice.
it's the shifting goalpost every time. It's like, if you could go back in time 10 years ago and say, you're going to have a book published, you'd be so content and you'd be so happy. But then once you find that out and you're like, okay, first of all, the first step is, wouldn't it be amazing to have an agent? Okay, you've got an agent. Wouldn't it be amazing to get a book deal? Okay, you've got a book deal. Wouldn't it be brilliant to have my book in the window of Waterstones? And then it just keeps shifting and shifting, and you're forever thinking, what's the next thing that I want? What's the next thing that I love? And I don't think that ever goes away. I think there are amazing, like you said, amazing writers out there that are probably still thinking, oh, but someone else got the book, or someone else did this and not me. So you have to just kind of enjoy the moment, and also, like, remember, because I think, like you say, it goes past very fast and you forget the good things. And I did at the beginning try to kind of save nice messages people had sent to me, but then kind of elapsed. And I think I'd like to go back and do that a bit more, because sometimes when I'm having a really bad day writing and I'm like, why am I bothering? And then someone says, oh, I loved your book. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's why I should carry on. That gives me the motivation. So yeah, hang on to all the good. So finally, Toby, I was wondering if you were able to give us any sort of hint or tease or taste of what you might be working on next.
I can't tell you a lot, not because I'm sworn to secrecy, but because I don't know that much.
That's fine.
But it's broadly about schools and safeguarding and the danger of radicalization of young people in schools, all kinds of radicalization.
Oh, that sounds great.
So that's sort of what I'm working on.
That sounds so interesting. And having read further and loving it, I'm very excited to see what's next for you. But let's enjoy the moment. Let's not look too far ahead. And
Enjoy the moment.
yeah, definitely. Toby, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
That was Toby Lloyd talking about his literary novel, Fervor, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors, and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.